Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And I've got the newest member of the House of Black, Brody King, here today. The former Ring of Honor star details his journey to AEW, explains where the idea came for him to join Malakai Black's faction. Brody talks about his relatively late start in wrestling, what inspired his name and gimmick, and how he's managed to achieve so much success in just 7 years. You hear about his training in California, his first PWG show, how he got signed to Ring of Honor, and what his first day at Ring of Honor was really like, since it also happened to be the last day for Cody Rhodes, the Young Bucks, Kenny Omega, Hangman Adam Page, and SCU. Brody's got stories about wrestling in Japan, doing the historic New Japan ROH show at Madison Square Garden, and what really happened with that Enzo and Cass run-in. And he's talking about his different factions, including Villain Enterprises with Marty Scurll and Violence Unlimited with Homicide. Brody's also had a long career in Hollywood as a rigger on movie and TV shows, very interesting, before he gave it up to pursue pro wrestling. He talks about his time on RuPaul's Drag Race, Parks and Recreation, Pirates of the Caribbean, and Spider-Man. Brody's got a metal band, too, called God's Hate. They're still making records and touring. You hear about how he works that all in and still manages to spend quality time with his wife and two young kids. All right, Brody King from the House of Black makes his Talk is Jericho debut starting now. All right, so this is one thing that I've said many times before, and I really dig about AEW, is after being in WWE and New Japan, and now here for the last 20 years, I don't really know what's going on the independent scene. So I guess about a month ago or 2 months ago, I saw this one brother just hanging around backstage, and I was like, well, that guy's got to be in the biz, and it was Brody King. And of course, you've made your AEW debut. But where was that? Where I saw you backstage? Where were you? Did you live near there? Where do you live at?
No, I was. I think it was either Indianapolis or Minneapolis.
That's right, because you're an LA guy.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I was just getting the steps prepared,
coming to hang out.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But that was funny because we'd never met, and I didn't really know much about you or your work. And obviously now I'm more in tune with it after seeing you a few times. But it's cool to me to meet guys that have been wrestling for a while and to kind of hear the story and all that sort of thing. So you definitely look like you belong in the biz.
Thank you.
So tell me kind of how your journey to get to AEW started, and how did you get here?
So I started training in May of 2014. And then I started wrestling actually in May. July of 2015.
Wow, so it's only been 6 or 7 years?
Yeah, almost 7 years.
Wow,
yeah.
Gotcha.
So it happened pretty quickly. I think I started at the right time. You know, obviously my size and look are more unique, I guess, for right now.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we started when wrestling was blowing up. You know, people weren't just looking to WWE for the only thing. They were looking at PWG, Ring of Honor, New Japan. Japan was really hot at the time, so it's like it was a great time to start wrestling.
Yeah, you know? Like pre COVID, basically the indie scene, including New Japan, was on fire.
Yeah, it was blowing up. So I also had, you know, some great trainers. My main trainer was Joey Chaos at Santino Brothers Wrestling Academy in Los Angeles. It's also where Brian Kendrick ran his school out of. Mm-hmm. So I got to, you know, do some stuff with Brian as well, and. At the time, Rocky Romero was also running classes at the Championship Wrestling from Hollywood school, which was much closer to my house than my actual school. Mm-hmm. So like every Wednesday, I would go and train with Rocky. And then every other day, I'd pretty much train at Santino's. And wrestling training was just my life for like a year and a half. I didn't see my friends. I didn't see my wife. Like, it was crazy. But yeah, from there, I was on the indies for about...
But slow down for 1 second. Okay. So when you started to train, because you mentioned it's only been 6 or 7 years, mm-hmm. what made you decide, like, and I don't even know, how old are you now?
I'll be 35 next
okay,
month.
Okay, so it's not something like you decided to do when you were 19. So no. What took you, you know, into your late 20s to decide you wanted to do it?
Yeah,
you
so must... I guess it is backtracking. So I just kind of have always done whatever I wanted in life, I guess. Mm-hmm. If there's something I was interested in or something I wanted to do, I was just going to do it. I've played in punk and hardcore bands my whole life, pretty much. And when I was 27, one of my friends started, he didn't really start, he met an old wrestler, and he was like, yeah, if you ever want to get in the ring, run the ropes, like take a bump. And my friend Colin was like a massive wrestling fan, so he's mm-hmm. like, yeah, of course I want to do that. I saw photos of him doing that. I was like, hey, how do I do this? And then we both went to a show at Santino's, and then the next day I signed up for wrestling training.
And what were you doing prior to that? I know you said you were in bands and stuff, but did you have a day job or anything? Or?
Yeah, I've been a set lighting technician for movies and TV for 15 years. I've been a union member, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's a whole other side of the story then.
It's yeah, I've done a lot of stuff. I've seen a lot of cool stuff. And it's funny because to me it's just normal, but like when I tell other people, like, whoa, please tell me more about that. Like last night someone had mentioned there was like a drag bar restaurant around the corner. I was like, oh, that's awesome. Like, I love going to that stuff. And mm-hmm. I think they thought I was joking at first. And I was like, oh, I worked on RuPaul's Drag Race for like 5 years. And they're like, nice. Whoa, you got to lead with that. I was like, I guess.
Exactly, right? That's interesting, though, because coming from that scene, we can go back to your wrestling career in a second, but kind of tell me a little bit about that world and kind of what your job is. Because when you do movies and TV, obviously being in front of the camera, but there's always, you know, dozens of cats behind the camera, and everyone's very important to the whole team and the whole production happening. So what was your job?
So my job, mainly, I was a rigger. So I would come in early, usually 6 a.m. shifts, till about 4 to 6 p.m. We would run cable. We would set up the power and lights and everything. And then the production crew would come in and, you know, shoot either the next day or that night or whatever was needed. My dad did it for 30 years. My grandfather did it for 60
oh, wow.
years. So it was like, you know, passed down to me when I graduated high school. It was like, I didn't really want to go to college. And my dad was like, well, do you want a job? I was like, oh, I guess.
It's your family legacy.
Yeah. It was, but, you know, I never really liked it that much. Like, uh-huh. it was a great job. It pays well. It's a great way to make a living. Honest work, you know. But sure. It wasn't... creative enough.
You
for
wanted
me,
to
I
be
guess.
In front of
the yeah. I wanted right, I wanted right. a little bit more.
What were some of the big productions that you worked on? You said RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah, so I that was like the most live stuff I did. I did Big Brother for a while. I worked on like Pirates of the Caribbean, Spider-Man, like huge, you know, productions. I was very lucky that my father was like well respected in the business, which, you know, coming in as an 18-year-old, I was kind of a shithead and like making adult money. It's like I just burn bridges like left and right, like taking days off and not wanting to work as hard as, you know, the old timers there.
You didn't know any better. Yeah.
Yeah. But then, you know, when you turn 23 and you're like, wow, I don't have any money and I need to pay rent and I have a girlfriend now. I better start making up all these things I f***ed up. So, you know, that was a good learning process for me. And I feel like becoming a wrestler later in life had a lot more advantages than disadvantages. You know, obviously people say, you know, your body doesn't hold up as well or whatever, but I feel like mentally I was prepared to be in a world with
interesting
other adults and, you know, have a more business approach or like a more responsible approach to it instead of, you know, going out and partying or whatever.
I think also more respect for kind of what it takes to put together the whole show.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. You know, I was talking to one of the audio guys yesterday on the plane and I feel like, whenever I talk to any of the production guys, when they find out what I did for like ever, they're like, oh, wow, like I can relate to them and I see how much work goes into this. And I know the effort and the, you know, what they go through to put this on for us. So mm-hmm. it's not lost on me at all to respect their side of it as well.
So when you did, let's say you said Pirates of the Caribbean and Spider-Man, that sort of thing, would the cast ever like talk, relate, socialize? I mean, because some people cool, some people not. Like, how did that work for you?
Yeah, so I mean, there was people that, you know, were definitely superstars, yeah. or, you know, they didn't, they just walked like you didn't exist. But a lot of the time, you know, a lot of them are really cool. Like on Pirates of the Caribbean, we were told like not to talk to Johnny Depp, right. but it was like, wasn't because he was an asshole. It's because he would just keep talking to you. And like, there'd be times where like, he would like try to start conversing with you or like play around with you. And you would see like the AD be like, oh, like shoo away.
Cause he's
like,
getting sidetracked. Yeah, from his gig,
yeah. He wants to play and he's supposed to be, you know, making $100 million movie.
right.
But yeah, there was a lot of cool people. When I worked on Parks and Recreation, like Nick Offerman was really awesome, and Amy Poehler was really cool. Like it was fun to be around.
You're part of the team. That's really cool.
Yeah. It's funny because it's like, you know, you see that at wrestling too, where you'll see some people like in their own world and they just don't talk to anyone else. But then there's the people that, you know, that act like everyone's part of the team and it's very welcoming. I mean, like, you on my first day, you pulled me aside, gave me notes and
said,
welcome to the team. And that, like, you're one of the biggest names here, and that's awesome.
Well, but like you said, though, I also understand there is a team that everybody's a part of, like a football team or a hockey team. Obviously, you have the, you know, football team, you got the Tom Brady's and the top stars, and then you got the guys that play for, you know, 30 seconds a game, but they're just as important. So I think it really is the same, especially in wrestling and in rock and roll too. I mean, our crew is just as important as the band in a lot of ways, and it's just as important to have a personal relationship with them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I feel like the people behind the scenes don't get as much respect as they deserve, yeah. and they're the ones that make it all happen. So.
Yeah.
I try to thank them, you know, walking in and out every time. So
that's cool, man. Yeah. So that's a cool background. I didn't know that about you. So you finally give up this day job. Was it hard to give up the gig to get into the possibility of maybe making it into wrestling?
I mean, I officially, like, I'm still not even technically retired from it. I officially, like, it's called honorable withdrawal, where you just kind of like step away. Mm-hmm. I did that last year, and like, I probably could have done that a couple years ago, but it just felt like it's such a big part of me that like, it felt like letting go was like wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just like, that was my job forever. But yeah, it was definitely a weird transition.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, when I started wrestling at 27, now I'm, trying to get booked on shows on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then go do my day job on Monday through Friday. And so it's like asking my boss for Fridays off or Mondays off if I'm flying around, and they're just like, why are you doing this? Yeah. Like, you're getting paid $100. Like, you could be at work making way more than that. And I'm like,
union job, yeah, benefits. Yeah,
exactly. Everything. And, you know, I'm taking care of my wife. I own a house, and it's just like, it seemed ridiculous on paper for especially like guys that have been doing it for 20 plus years. They're just like, this is, what are you doing? And then it's like, just I think I got something here. Mm-hmm. And then for it to all pay off now, it's like, I got a lot of my union brothers like texting me like, I saw you on TV tonight, that's awesome. Like, or, you know, going back and be like, yeah, I wrestled at Madison Square Garden this weekend. They're like, holy shit, that's awesome.
So that's the payoff, right?
Yeah. But you know, I did the indies for 3 years, just grinding, not sleeping much. And then I got signed to Ring of Honor in 2018,
mm-hmm.
and spent 3 years there. Meanwhile, I was doing New Japan as well.
Because there was a connection between Ring of Honor and New Japan, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And also, you know, having Rocky as one of my trainers was a good foot in the door.
Right.
He did a lot for me. He's helped a lot in my career. He was, you know, essential in putting me in contact with Ring of Honor and kind of like guiding me through that process. And, you know, not even just that, but training me was
sure. Well, it's something that you mentioned too, like when you're talking about 15, 16, 17, when the indies were very hot, also guys were getting smaller. Like, we see it here, even in AEW. At first, when we started, it was Luchasaurus and Jay Hager were our two big guys, yeah. I'm a big guy. And then, you know what I mean? Like, then there's all the kind of smaller guys that kind of populate the business now. You're obscenely big, very big guy. So did that help you stand out at the start when you got into the business?
Yeah, I mean, being tattooed from like my neck to my
everywhere, throat, stomach, yeah. chest,
everything.
Yeah.
That, you know, alone makes you stand out. But being, you know, 6'6" also helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was easy for me to get my foot in the door, but then, you know, I had to also have the goods to back it up, you know? So I was very appreciative of the training that I was put through. You know, I know a lot of guys go through shorter training periods. They'll have like a, you know, 3 month thing, and they're like, all right, now go out there and do your thing. And it might work for some people, but for me personally, I wanted to be more of a finished product, like coming out. So I spent like a year and a half, and it was like, it was frustrating. And there was like times where I'm like, when can I debut? And my, my trainer's like, just be patient. And then I'm glad I did, because when I finally did, it was like, oh damn, this guy's good.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
What did you figure out about wrestling early on that you didn't think was going to be as hard? Like, for like when you get in the business, like some people think, oh, well, I'll just come in. This should be easy. That should be easy. And then you realize, like, oh, my gosh, this is not as easy as I expected.
Honestly, not much, because like I feel like touring and stuff like that really got me prepared for what I was.
Touring with your band?
Yeah, getting into it. So, and also, you know, doing union work, I have to call different bosses and kind of like put myself out there. You have to network a lot. So the networking part of it, I had down. Making merchandise, I had down because of my band. Traveling was fine. And it's like, I'm used to sleeping on a floor next to a, you know, dog piss. So I didn't care. So it's like when someone's putting you up in a shitty hotel, you're like, this is awesome. So a lot of it was like, I was very prepared for, and, you know, is was almost a step up from what I was used to.
And the band is God's Hate.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So
you had done a lot of touring with that band.
Well, I'd been in bands prior to that. God's Hate started like right when I started wrestling training almost. Gotcha. So they kind of have lived parallel to each other. We had some decent success up until 2018-ish. And then when I got signed to Ring of Honor, that was like kind of full time.
Yeah.
So God's Hate kind of went to the back burner. But then during quarantine, that was kind of like a blessing for that. Was like, well, what do we do now? We don't have anything to do for a whole year. So we wrote a record and it got a lot of praise. And now we're doing more with that. And with the schedule here at AEW, it's awesome. It's like you wrestle Wednesday, maybe Friday. And then it's like you got the whole weekend to do whatever you want. So it's kind of the perfect schedule for both.
Is it a hardcore band?
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So, you know, more in the vein of like Hatebreed and Madball and Terror and stuff like that. Agnostic Front.
You got the look for it.
Yeah. you know, it kind of breeds a certain type of human. You look like a caveman with tattoos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you were touring before that with other bands, you mentioned?
Yeah. So I'd been on a couple full U.S. tours with friends' bands and, you know, just...
Like roadieing or...
Just, you know, TMing or doing whatever, you know, for no money. And you're just like, I want to go see the world. Like, I want to go see the whole United States, which is also, you know, a ridiculous thing to tell your boss. It's like, I'm not going to make any money, but I'll be gone for a month.
But there's a certain wanderlust to it, though. You know, I've had the same when I first started as well. It's like you want to get out there and do something. And if you enjoy what you do, the money will follow. You can never really do anything just for money, because that usually leads to not being happy with it.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, so exactly. And that's kind of how I've always lived my life. And, you know, my grandfather was kind of like a con man, I guess. Like, he was always like scheming and like moving around. Like, my mom would talk about how they moved every state and like...
Like in the dead of night?
In the dead of night, they'd be woken up. It's like, we got to go. And like, they'd be moving to a different state the next
day.
What
kind of stuff did he do?
I don't know. He's just like, you know... selling weed and grifting and just doing
snake oil salesman.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. That was him to a T, even, you know, to the day he died. Was like, he was always scheming on something, and it was always like, what's he up to? And nobody really knew, but he would, you know, leave for a month and come back. It's like, where you been? He's like, oh, I just been around. Like, so I feel like part of that is in my blood, to where it's like, I can't just stay in one place and work the same job every day and be fulfilled.
So was your first kind of big break Ring of Honor or MLW?
So they kind of happened close to each other.
Right.
I would say my first big break was PWG.
Oh, wow.
So in 2018, February 2018, I had just flown to Ohio to do a show. It was Sammy Callahan's Pro Wrestling Revolver. And it was a Wednesday. The show was on a Friday. And I get a text from Rick Knox, the referee here at AEW. And he goes, hey, check your email. And I was like, okay. So I look at my email and it's an email from PWG. And it says, hey, are you available Friday? We had an injury. Can you come in? It's like, this is like, being from Southern California, that was like,
that was
my main goal, like at the time. Yeah. That was the pinnacle of like independent wrestling.
You always heard about PWG being sold out like in 3 minutes and yeah. It was an exclusive club, hard to get in.
I mean, I as a trainee, I was like in the crowd watching the matches. So it's like, yes, like, and I talked to Sammy, he's like, go. And so that was cool. I basically landed in Ohio. Was there for 2 hours, got back on a plane and flew back to LA.
For the show that night or the next night?
Yeah. And, wow. And it was just like, all right, so here we are. I wrestled Adam Brooks that night and it was like, it was awesome. You know, I'm billed from Van Nuys, California. It's in Reseda, which is like the next town over. And, you know, when the announcer said, you know, from Van Nuys, California, the whole place like erupted. It was like, I feel like I was blown up before the match even started.
right.
But that was like the first big momentum push for me. Mm-hmm. And then MLW contacted me after that. Court had me do a lot of stuff that with like bigger names. That was really cool. Mm-hmm. I got to wrestle MVP. Mm-hmm. I got to do stuff with like Shane Strickland, me and MJF wrestled a couple times there. So it's like, I got to meet a lot of people there. I think I might've met Darby there, but I might've met him before that. I can't remember,
right.
But it was like, you know, the bigger names on the independents. And that's where I started like really socializing and networking with those guys and becoming friends with everyone.
You must have had a pretty natural ability out of the gate to be wrestling with those guys after 2 or 3 years. You must have taken to wrestling very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the physicality part of it was natural to me, I guess, from being, you know, at punk and hardcore shows where they're incredibly physical and like you're jumping off the stage and landing on concrete. So it's like, yeah. When we were learning how to dive, it was like, yep, I got it. And they're like, what? Like, you're the biggest guy here. And it's like, I do a topic on heel over the top rope. And they're like, okay.
You just envision that you're on the stage. Yeah. Jumping it's off, like, right?
Wait, I have someone to catch me. This is awesome.
They're not going
to
part like the Red Sea.
Well, you know, not all the time.
Yeah. Right. I love that too, when the guy completely blows the catch, but as soon as you fall and hit the ground, he puts his arm over you.
Yeah, you see this one, and yeah. Like their arm goes down, and then fall.
Like, the guy goes like, get your hands off me.
Don't touch me.
You already missed me. So where did the name Brody, is that obviously a tribute to Bruiser?
Yeah, yeah. So I guess when I was picking my wrestling name, it was just like, you know, beating your head against the wall.
It's hard.
I think I had some stupid names like Maximus King or something else. Like, I don't know. I think my training partner and tag partner, Tyler Bateman, might've been like, why don't you use Brody? Like, you look mm-hmm. similar, like you have a similar style. Like, and Brody Lee was also like one of the people that I was watching a lot when his independent runs on Chikara and stuff. And then obviously, you know, his stuff in WWE, I thought that he was really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So both of those was like, yeah, this is a good fit. Like, you know, he was Luke Harper at the time. So
right.
I was like, all right,
I'll take it.
Yeah. Let's be Brody King, I guess. And then my wrestling trainer Chaos did not like it. And I was like, well, this is it. And I feel like I was like one of the first students to tell him that. Cause you know, it was always like an old school thing where like your trainer kind of gives you your name. And, you know, I'm defiant at the core. Yeah, so it was like, yeah, this is my name. And now he calls it like the Brody curse, where like a student will be like, this is my name. And it's like ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, this is not your name. And they still go with it. And he's like, this is your fault. I'm like, it's not my fault. My name is good.
I was like that. My very first match, obviously Chris Jericho, I came up with. My original idea was Jack Action, which Lance Storm said, that's terrible. So I said, Chris Jericho. But they wanted to call me Cowboy Chris Jericho because it was up in Calgary. From Casper, Wyoming, Cowboy Chris Jericho. And I'm like, I hate cowboys. I hate country music. And I remember my friend who was the veteran was like, well, then just don't do it. And I was like, yeah, I just won't do it. And I could just imagine like some guy, like you're the same, your first day of wrestling school or whatever, saying, I'm not using this name. if this was like, you know, another time, somebody could shave your eyebrows, kick you out of the class, beat the shit out of you, but for some reason, we got away with it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, they saw something in us, are like, yeah, they're going to be fine.
Whatever.
Yeah,
whatever it is.
Let me be whoever he wants.
Exactly. So when you went to Ring of Honor, because I know you've been in a lot of factions, and obviously you're here in one right now with Malakai, but I think Ring of Honor was Violence Unlimited. Is that the right one?
So we started
there's a couple other.
We started with Villain Enterprises.
So how did that come to be, and who was in that?
Marty Scurll and PCO
gotcha.
were the first incarnation of it, and then Flip Gordon joined later on.
Okay.
That was a huge deal for me, you know. Marty was like one of the biggest wrestlers in the world at the time.
Absolutely.
And so for him to like message me like, hey, I have this idea, like, would you be interested? It's like, yeah. He's like, do you want to go on a tour of Australia? I'm like, yes.
Yeah, right.
So it was just like, that was really awesome. You know, me and PCO, we got to do some crazy stuff together. We won the Ring of Honor tag titles. We won the Crockett Cup. And
unbelievable.
We won,
what a comeback story for him too, right?
Unbelievable comeback story. And he's like one of the nicest human beings ever. I don't know how much...
Only a few interactions with him, but always the nicest guy.
Yeah, fellow Canadian.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's great, and he's hilarious. Like, just, he's from a completely different era than us, but he's just, like, riding with these new kids. And it's like, one day was really funny. I was, like, trying to joke with him, and then he burned me good. He was like, oh, I was thinking tonight in the match, maybe I do, like, the capture lariat. And I was like, Carl, you're just going to steal my move like that? Because I'd been doing it for, you know, a year. He goes, I didn't know you were doing it in 1996 when I did it with Bret Hart. I was like, oh. So I was like, all right, you can do whatever you want.
Kind of put you, stopped in your tracks on that one.
Yeah, it's like, fair enough. Well played.
Were you able to learn from him at all? Not just obviously from the wealth of experience, but the fact that he was, you know, pretty much drummed out of the business in a lot of ways, and then made this huge comeback to where he's still, you know, signing new contracts to this day.
Yeah, I mean, he had a lot, you know, like you said, from the bottom to the top, kind of, he made a lot of mistakes, and he's aware of them, and he would kind of, you know, tell us, like, this is what happened, like, and from those stories, you can definitely learn a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can also learn a lot from him in-ring, what to do, sometimes what not to do, like... Maybe it's, I'm not going to take a powerbomb onto the floor from the ring.
It's crazy. So I just watched him the other day do a senton, swanton from the top post onto the apron.
Yeah.
And basically take a flat back bump on the floor. I was like, what are you doing?
One day, so it was after the Crockett Cup. We had three matches that day. He took that same move onto the apron, and the padding was kind of missing. So he just landed on steel and wood. And afterwards, he was like limping bad, and I was like, oh man, is this it? Like, and he was like barely able to get in his room. I kind of like helped him to his room. He was using his bag as like a crutch.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, I hope he's okay. The next morning, he's like hopping around at breakfast. I'm like, dude, you really aren't human.
He's
like,
not human.
It is, yeah. It's not a gimmick.
So what did you base your style on? Like, do you seeing a few of your matches here, but are you more in the PCO mode, or are you in the more in the Brody mode, just beating the shit out of guys? That's kind of what I saw.
Yeah.
Or do you do both?
So when I started, you know, my school was heavily based in Lucha as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I got to learn all that. And, you know, being an athletic big man, you kind of want to show that off. So like the first few years, it
especially
was like
in the indies.
Yeah. It was like doing unnecessary things just for the sake of doing it. But I feel like as I, New Japan helped a lot with it, and so did Ring of Honor, just like refining it, like making those moments mean more, and like
right.
when to use them, you know, keep your body more healthy.
Well, also too, the fact that you're an anomaly being as big as you are, it's something that when we first, once again, bringing up Luchasaurus again, when we first started with AEW, and I was like, dude, you gotta pick your spots and stop doing all this. Look at the size of you and look at the stuff you're doing that everyone does. Just beat people up and do some cool things. Like, that's why I think Jake Hager was a standout when he first came, because he was a big guy who just was tough.
Yeah.
And beat guys up and clotheslined them and slammed them and Vader splashed him. And it was different from everything else that was going on.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for that, especially like in a time where there's not a lot of
right
brawlers, or there's not a lot of big guys in general.
Guys.
So it's like when you're believable and it looks like you could whoop someone's ass and you do, it's like, well, that was cool.
Right.
So that's, you know, I did adapt that style a lot, of more of a brawler style, but also, you know, I sprinkle in the athletic stuff.
Of course.
When needed. And so, yeah, from Villain Enterprises, we went to Violence Unlimited. That kind of started in quarantine. And then that was me, Chris Dickinson, Homicide, and Tony Deppen. And it was like three guys that like I wanted to work with individually. And then like it just kind of worked out to where it became a group. And again, like, you know, having PCO and Villain Enterprises, now we have Homicide in Violence Unlimited. And it's like he was at the very first Ring of Honor show, which then he was at this very last final battle. So hearing his stories and like learning from him was awesome. And, you know, I've always loved just sitting around the older guys and just listening to what they have to say. Because, you know, it could be some ridiculous story, but like there's going to be a piece of that that you're like, huh, I didn't know that. Or like you could learn from it.
Right.
So being with him was awesome. And me and Chris built like a bond, and we kind of carried that over to New Japan. And we were doing a lot of the New Japan Strong shows here in the U.S. as a tag team, which is still going now. So from there, we've kind of flashed forward to now.
Let's go back to Ring of Honor, though. You mentioned like during quarantine, Violence Unlimited started. And I know from a couple of the Ring of Honor dudes that I've spoken to, because Ring of Honor was the one company that really wasn't working at all, but they still had you guys under contract and were still basically paying you.
Yeah.
So what was that like for you? I mean, obviously being at home for that much and then making money is great, but it seems it was almost the beginning of the end of Ring of Honor in retrospect.
Yeah. You know, I think that they took great care of us. Like, I can't complain one bit. You know, I have two children and a wife. You know, my son's turning 3 on Sunday and my daughter's 1.5.
Yeah.
So it's like my wife was pregnant during quarantine. My son was 2 at the time. And it was just like this weird, uncertain time.
Yeah.
And, you know, to get that call from Ring of Honor and be like, stay home. Like, you'll continue getting paid. It's all good. Like, we'll pick up where we left off. Was like a huge sigh of relief, because it's like, we don't want to travel. We don't want to put our families at risk, like stuff like that. And it was just like, to get that was awesome. But then, you know, on the flip side of it, coming out of quarantine, it was like kind of a rocky start, and then it never really picked up. And then it was like, you know, kind of the end of Ring of Honor as we knew it at the time.
Did you see the writing on the wall and start thinking about different options? Or, because you mentioned Final Battle, and they announced at the time that this will be kind of the end of Ring of Honor as you know it for, you know, a few months or whatever it may be. When did you start thinking maybe I should think about moving along?
Yeah, so I felt like I could see the writing on the wall. I don't know if a lot of people could, because I feel like a lot of people were kind of surprised by the news, which, you know, if you've been with the company for years, maybe it is surprising. But, you know, when you see these huge productions and the crowds are just minimal or none, it's like, this can't continue.
Especially when, and I talked to Jay Lethal about this, when it's owned by a big conglomerate like Sinclair, and there's people that are the bean counters that don't really know what Ring of Honor is, don't care. They just know, why are we spending 7 figures, 8 figures on this and getting, you know, 1 figure back in revenue? Cut it.
Yeah. You know, the tax write-off is only good
for so long.
So, you know, I don't know exactly what the final decision was or who it was from, but I understand. You know, it sucks, and it put a lot of people out of work. And hopefully, you know, I know they're rebooting and they have a show, Mania Weekend. And, you know, I hope nothing for the best for them, because they treated me very well. They gave me a lot of opportunities that, you know, I wrestled at Madison Square Garden, sold out. It was like, that was a dream moment for a professional wrestler or a musician.
Absolutely.
So it's like, to say that I was able to do that, who knows when I'll be able to say it.
Well, the fact too that you were able to do that outside of the WWE system.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that, because I've never really discussed that with anybody, the whole New Japan Ring of Honor joint show in Madison Square Garden, which I was actually going to do against Tanahashi. And then both Tony Khan and Vince McMahon asked me not to do it. That's a whole other story. We could do a whole podcast just on that. But I didn't do the show, obviously, but you did. So kind of talk about all that, because that's a big, big deal.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. You know, my first day at Ring of Honor was all of the Elite's last. So it was like a real weird changing of the guard.
Cody and Matt and Nick and,
and
Hangman.
All of SCU.
Wow.
So it was very bizarre. I have a funny story that, you know, I had my first match at Ring of Honor, and it was kind of a whatever match. And it was supposed to be something that it wasn't, and we kind of got scolded a little bit for it. Like, we gave the other guys too much. Me and PCO are supposed to be monsters. Gotcha. Just run them over.
That happens.
It's like, well, we were just doing what we were told. It's our first day. We don't know. Christopher Daniels and BJ Whitmer come up to me, and they're like, hey, if that ever happens again, like, please grab us and let us know. I was like, okay, cool, awesome. So I'm like, yeah, BJ and CD are on my side. That was their last day there. So, it was a really weird time. And I was put in the position to kind of take those guys' place with Villain Enterprises. And it was like, that's big shoes to fill.
Right.
So, you know, and I think that the initial sellout of MSG was with the thought that Kenny and the Bucks and you and like all these other guys are going to be there.
All the guys that were in New Japan and Ring of Honor up until that date. Right.
So it was like, well, we better put on a damn good show. Thankfully, it was still sold out. Like, the place was packed when we did it. You know, it was rocky. It was up and down. And I feel like it was maybe not what people were expecting. I had a great time. My match was awesome.
Your match?
It was a four-way tag match. It was me and PCO versus the Briscoes versus G.O.D. versus Evil and Sonata. So it was like, you know, all guys that I look up to, and being in that ring, in that arena was crazy. Right. Under the New Japan and Ring of Honor banner was awesome. But then even that match got tainted by the weird Enzo and Cass running thing at the
end. That's what all that happened?
Yeah, it was like
Bubba Ray beating somebody up.
It's funny because it's like, people ask me, like, how come you didn't get involved? I was like, I didn't know what was happening. Like,
they kept it a complete secret from you guys.
Nobody told us anything. And like, PCO just got powerbombed outside of the ring. So like, my first thought when the match was over was like, make sure he's alive.
Right.
So I went over to him, got him up, and we start walking out and see like a commotion in the corner. And I couldn't really see who was fighting who. I just saw like the Briscoes and Bully. I was like, oh, they're doing something weird over there. So I kind of just shuffled Carl off to the side to make sure he was okay. And then afterwards, people were coming up to me like, why was Enzo and Cass out there? I was like, what are you talking about?
Ah, wow.
And it's like, then I like look on the internet and it's like, what is happening? And then it's like asking people like, did you know this was happening? And it was like, to this day, I don't really know the full.
And nothing really happened afterwards too. They kind of came in and came out.
Yeah. I feel like it was like so low key that like nobody, like they didn't film it. Like, I remember watching the match back. You can clearly hear Colt Cabana, who was on commentary, being like, film away from that. And they like cut to the commentator's desk. And it was like, it was really strange.
Thought it was a shoot.
Yeah. Like, so wow. I think there was, you know, whoever was involved didn't really put the proper people in the know. But that was a very strange situation. And then, you know, there was just, I feel like the anticipation of having the bigger names and the bigger matches just weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Okada and Jay White had an unbelievable match there, but
it's not what you were expecting. I feel when like those tickets went on sale.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Okada and Kenny or something along those lines, for example.
I feel like people were already kind of in the, well, let's see what happens. And then they had already set their expectations too high, and it wasn't that.
It was a special night, though. I mean, because the show was on, the show was off. Vince was furious that it was on, and you guys had it anyways.
Yeah, I don't know the actual, but wasn't it like the first time someone's ran MSG in like 20 years or something like
Maybe
that?
Maybe even more. The first time that somebody other than a McMahon had ran a wrestling show in the Garden, like you said, in 20 years, or if it was one in 20 years, it was one out of 50 years. It was a very, very long time.
So, yeah, like, you know, that's history making.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, to be able to have my parents in the crowd and my friends came, and it's just like, it was a cool night. And, you know, my dad gets to go and brag that his son wrestled at
Madison Square Garden, right?
Yeah, that's all I care about.
It's funny, once you get a little jaded, it's like Madison Square, it's hard to get in there, and it's impossible to park your car, and it costs so much for union fees, but throw all that the window. It's the freaking Garden.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
It's awesome. And it's funny because, you know, Eddie Kingston and I were pretty close on the indies. Like, he taught me a lot, kind of took me under his wing, which was another reason why I wanted Homicide in my faction, because Homicide was Eddie's mentor.
Gotcha.
So it was like kind of, you know, paying back the favor, but also learning from someone that I respected and that I learned from.
Right.
Eddie had told me before we did MSG, he's like, just do me a favor. Like, when you come out, just look up. And it was just like, okay. So I like come out on the ramp, and it's just like this overwhelming feeling of like, holy shit, this is huge. And then like you look up and you see the big dome ceiling and everything. Yeah. And it's just like, well, that's incredible. And so it's like, I'm glad that I remembered that and did that. And, you know, that was a special.
You got to enjoy the moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You really do, for something like that, especially. Let's talk about New Japan, because I think for me, and going there as many times as I have, you would be tailor-made for that company. And it seems like you had a fairly good time there. How many tours did you do there?
I've only done one full tour.
Oh, okay.
So I was supposed to do a second, but then I hurt my knee and gotcha. I couldn't. So the first tour I did there was in 2019. Yeah. 2019, I did the Best of Super Juniors tour as Marty's. Like,
obviously.
Here. Oh. Yeah. Yes, I was in the Super Juniors tour.
It is Japan. Who knows? Yeah.
But, you know, they have the tag matches on the off days of the tournament. So I was doing tag matches with Marty. And at the end of Super Juniors, it was kind of this crazy full circle moment. So in 2017, my band God's Hate got to go tour in Japan.
Really?
Yeah, we played 5 shows in Japan. It was like 2 in Tokyo. And then we played Osaka, Nagoya, and somewhere
else. Dude, I have been trying to get Fozzy over to Japan for 20 fucking years. How did you do it?
It's crazy because, like, you know, a lot of stuff like that, being in punk and hardcore, it's just like this tight-knit circle that, like, you could just kind of almost make anything happen. It's like, you know, we didn't make any money, but we didn't.
You got to go to Japan.
Yeah, they paid for our travel and they paid for our bus and stuff. It's like the experience alone was everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, my wife is like a huge fan of Japanese culture and anime and stuff like that. So we went and did a like 10-day vacation prior to going on tour there.
And you're the singer in the band, right?
I am the singer of the band. Yeah. So I was able to actually train for a couple days. Rocky helped me, put me in contact with Kyoko Kimura, who was Hana Kimura's mother. And I went to the Ice Ribbon Dojo and they had like kind of a mixed class, and I got to train for a couple days there, which was really awesome. And I got to meet them. And then we went to a New Japan show at the Sumo Hall, Ryogoku, and watched Trent and Rocky win the tag belts there. So it's like sitting in the crowd, you know, on the concrete slabs and stuff, watching that in the arena was like, oh, this is awesome. Like, I would love to be here.
Right.
Flash forward to that Super Juniors tournament. The tournament's getting towards the end of it. And, you know, the last day, you don't really know what you're doing. It could be like a 10-man tag or whatever. And I asked Rocky, I was like, hey, you know, are me and Marty doing anything on the last day? And he goes, oh, yeah. I remember we were in the Don Quixote that's like across the street from the Dome Hotel. And he's just like casually like getting, you know, strong zero or whatever. And he's just like, oh, yeah. You and Marty versus me and Okada. I was like, what? It's just like that. Okay. I guess that's happening.
That's
now.
Great.
So it's like, I got to wrestle Rocky, who's one of my trainers, in the arena that I watched him win the tag belts against Okada.
Yeah.
Who's one of the greatest wrestlers
ever. Right.
So it's like, it was a crazy, crazy moment.
So they must have liked, they probably matched you up with Okada a few times just to judge the reaction from the crowd and everything.
No, that was.
But I mean, during that match.
Oh, yeah. We, you know, it was, that was a crazy thing, you know, calling the match with him. And it's like, he's like, oh, what do you want to do here? I was like, I don't know, pile driver? He goes, okay. It's like, okay. So, yeah, being able to do that there was unreal. It's another bucket list moment.
So it was just the one tour that you did? Only one time?
Yeah. So then we were supposed to do tag league. Me and PCO were supposed to do tag league, and then I hurt my knee. So
gotcha.
We had to be off of tag league, and then COVID happened.
Of course.
But it was, a strange moment. In the middle of quarantine, they started doing the New Japan Strong shows, which started as like an idea, and it was like, we don't really know where this is going to go.
It's basically American New Japan.
Yeah, we're going to try to shop it around and see what happens. And they had like a completely different roster. It was like guys that, you know, I knew but weren't really getting a lot of recognition everywhere else. So it was cool to watch this thing be built from the ground up and to be part of that from the beginning. And, you know, when we were first able to do our first live shows, it was like, this is our moment to like show everyone. And now it's kind of like a touring thing. So it's been really, really awesome to watch that and be part of that. Hopefully, you know, when the borders open back up, we'll be able to.
Oh, yeah. I think we're all waiting for that now. Yeah. You know, I think an AEW invasion of New Japan would be big money for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, I think in both countries.
Yeah. I mean, the matchups in my head, like just thinking about this right now, are like endless.
As we start to wind down, how did you hook up with Malakai, and what company was that in?
So I met Malakai in 2017, I believe. It was either 17 or 16. He was doing Bola, and my friend Andy Williams, who's the butcher here at AEW.
Me, you, and Andy got to put together a band.
A little super group within AEW.
Yeah, exactly.
That'd be awesome. Yeah. He was like, hey, come to Denny's. Like, I didn't go to the Bola that year. And he's like, come to Denny's, like, hang out. And I was like, okay, cool. So it was like 10 minutes from my house. And him and Malakai were eating there. And that's where I met him for the first time. And we just started talking. We kind of hit it off. You know, we have mutual friends. We like mutual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we just kind of like, I think Andy might have started a group chat with like all of us. And then it just became a friendship from there. And then he got signed to WWE. I was at his first match there, the NXT TakeOver. Like, if you watch it back, him and Andrade, you can see me like in the front row. Like, they had me like the friends and family section. I was like, oh, I guess. Like,
friend, giant friend.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that was cool to watch him do that. And then, you know, see where he got to go from there. And then when he got released, it was like kind of at the same time that, you know, the uncertainty of Ring of Honor in my head started happening. And we just kind of had like, you know, this idea of like, what if we did this? What if we did the House of Black?
So you had never actually done that prior?
No.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so it was like, you know, this kind of seems like a perfect fit. Like, what do you think about doing, you know, just trying it out? And PWG had reached out and was like, hey, would you guys be interested in doing some tag stuff?
Mm.
And Malakai was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, just see where it goes. And then that just kind of like turned into what it is now. So it was like all these like moments just kind of collided into one. And it was like, and we were talking about it the other night, that just this like fun idea that we had as friends is now like, you know, it's a thing.
And that's
like,
usually how it goes.
Yeah.
Right.
Like you said, you know, when you're having fun, that's usually when you make the money.
Yeah, money follows.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the most important lesson that I can say to anybody. You know, if you're enjoying what you're doing, the money will follow. You know, if you're doing it for the money, it probably won't follow.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And you know, that's kind of like when you start making money, it's like you have to kind of check yourself and being like, if you keep, you know, don't push it. Just keep doing what got you here. And that's kind of what, you know, I live my life by. And like, even with music and stuff like that, it's like, you know, God's Hate doesn't do a lot, but what we do is, you know, kind of important. Like, we'll play bigger shows or we'll play with bigger bands. And it's like, let's not do stuff just for the sake of doing it, because then it's like, you know, you're just kind of wearing yourself out.
Sure.
You're overexposing yourself. I feel the same with wrestling. It's like, make everything important. You know, every match counts.
Right.
I've never been a wrestler that wants to like phone it in, or like you're on a smaller show and you're like, I could just, you know, do whatever. It's like, I always want to give the fans what they're expecting. And I feel like up until this point I have. So hopefully I continue to do so.
That's a Fit Finley lesson. You never make the people who paid suffer.
Yeah.
You know, if there's 10 people, you know, 10 or 10,000, that's a rock and roll thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
And trust me, I've been there.
So
in wrestling and yeah, you know, like doing a lucha show in front of five people, and you're like, well, let's go do it, guys.
Did you ever have any inquiries from WWE at all?
I had some talks. You know, I chatted with Regal a few times. He gave me a great piece of advice. You know, I think I talked to him the Bola of 2018. He was in the crowd, and I kind of pulled him to the side after my match. I was like, you know, do you have any notes for me? And like, we had met a couple times before, and he was always very nice to me. He was always very welcoming,
yeah, very
and like gave me a lot of great advice and great critiques and stuff. And he was like, you know, you're a great wrestler. Like, you're obviously going to do great stuff. Like, your style is obviously more fit for something like Ring of Honor at the time or New Japan. He's like, go do all of these things that you want. And after you're done with that, if you want to come to WWE, here's my number.
Yeah.
So it was like, well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, being a person that doesn't want to be in one spot, going to the same place every time, it was like, okay, let's see where this takes me. And, you know, as time has progressed, WWE just wasn't in my sights. I feel mm-hmm. like, you know, the style or anything, like, it just wasn't for me. I love New Japan Pro Wrestling. I feel like it's,
yeah,
in essence, that is like what I want to be as a professional wrestler. And I feel like a lot of that is translated to AEW mm-hmm. now. It's just like the...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's like, it's the perfect fit. And being in AEW is awesome because I get to spend a lot of time with my family still. I get to watch my kids grow up and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's hard, you know, being a full-time guy in Japan. You know, a lot of these guys like Tama Tonga and T, they were there for...
Chase Owens told me he was there for like 3 months.
Yeah.
Because you got to do the 2-week quarantine.
Chase has been there forever.
I know. But he said, he's like, this is my job. And I'm like, oh, I know.
But it's like, you know, Thomas said, you know, he got to watch his kid walk for the first time over FaceTime. It's like stuff like that's hard. Yeah, it's mentally taxing on you. And I feel like, you know, I'm very grateful that I have the opportunity to still work for New Japan while doing full-time AEW stuff. It's like the best of both worlds.
How did you end up in AEW?
Persistence, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, I had met Tony a few years ago. He knew who I was. And then I feel like just cutting my teeth in Ring of Honor and like meeting the Bucks and meeting a couple other people, it was just like all these pieces kind of fell into place. And then, you know, with Malakai joining, it was like kind of the perfect fit. He kind of pitched the idea to Tony, and Tony liked it a lot. And, you know, I had come out, I had talked to him when we all got released from Ring of Honor. I messaged him and he was like, yeah, you know, let's try to catch up sometime. And I was like, well, I can be anywhere within a few hours. And he's like, well, why don't you come out to Indianapolis and Minneapolis? I was like, all right, I'll be there. So I flew myself out there and we talked, and here I am now.
That's great, yeah, to come up there. It's very easy to deal with Tony.
So it is, and he's an incredibly kind person, too. It's crazy, like, knowing what he's involved in on a day-to-day basis between, like,
oh my gosh,
wrestling and football and soccer. It's like my head would explode. So it's like the fact that he has even 2 minutes to talk to another human is crazy.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah, it's been a really awesome experience. Everyone here is very cool and welcoming, and it's like everywhere you turn there's someone that you can learn from. It's like, you know, you or Dean Malenko or Big Show or Mark Henry, it's like anywhere is like you can go to someone and get a different piece mm-hmm. of advice or a different opinion. And you know, that's what I want the most, is like when I come out of a match, I don't want to know what I did good. I want to know what I did bad.
What can I do better?
Or what can I do better?
And it's interesting, too, like when you have guys like Mark Henry and Big Show to talk to, and they probably see you in a lot of a different way because you're a big guy.
Yeah.
So when they give you advice, it's like big guy to big guy. Like, I can't give you big guy to big guy advice, but they can.
Yeah. Right? And that's like something that I've been lacking, I feel like, in wrestling. It's like there's not a lot of, you know, big guys of that caliber that have been to that level that are able to kind of tell me, you know, you should do this or you should do that, or maybe try this. It's like, and that's what I want. So that's like a cool opportunity that I get here that I didn't get anywhere else, really.
Last few questions for you. And I always love hearing these. You mentioned traveling up and down the roads with the different bands. What's the worst gig you ever played? Does one stand out for you? Ours was opening for the Murder Junkies. Not Gigi Allen and the Murder Junkies, just the Murder Junkies. I'm like, who the fuck put Fozzy and the Murder Junkies? Savannah, Georgia, there was 50 skinheads in the crowd. And
God.
It was awful.
I mean, there's been a few bad shows. I'm just, I mean, there's just been shows where like entire fights break out that spill into the street and then the show gets shut down. It's just like, but then, you know, then there's the ones where you like show up and like you said, you're kind of in the middle of nowhere and it's like, there is 10 people here.
Yeah.
I think maybe the worst show, which is kind of funny. We were playing an after show for this fest called United Blood, and
where was that at?
It was in Richmond, Virginia, gotcha. Which is like usually like we're on fire there.
Yeah.
And the show started at like 11:30, and there was only three bands, but the second band took forever to set up. They played forever. And it's like, by the time we went on, it was like 2:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it's like, these kids have been at a fest all day.
Yeah.
And they were going the next day too. So it was like, there was probably like 30 people there and they're just like shot. And yeah. It's like, this sucks. Yeah. It's the middle of the morning and we are playing aggressive music. This is not what anybody wants yeah. right now.
At 2:30 in the morning, right?
Yeah. And yeah, so that was like, that was one of the worst ones. And yeah, you know, we could go on about, if I really thought about it, I'm sure plenty would come to mind of weird stuff that's just happened.
Because the hardcore scene always intrigues me, because it is, like you said, there's a world where people will live and die for it, but it's more of a direct demographic,
yeah.
you know, like a family demographic, but there's not tons and tons of people in that world.
Yeah, well, which is kind of awesome to be part of AEW now and like exposing, you know, a whole nother group of people to this type of music. And like, you know, me and Malachi are able to like show them bands through our wrestling, like, you know, our entrance music, my entrance music is my band, his entrance music is, you know, a kind of an obscure death metal like doom band. My best friend Colin wrote the music for our tag team entrance. It's like all these, we have very many different
sure
songs within our group that like people are now able to be like, oh, what's that? And like maybe they'll check out my band and then they'll find, you know, a whole list of bands that they're into now. And that's like, when I was a kid, that's what I did. You know, I saw guys like The Undertaker and I saw that he was like tattooed and stuff. I was like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah,
this
intriguing.
Is
like, yeah.
And that's what got me into wrestling. And then from wrestling, I got into music and it was just like,
I mean, Ultimate Warrior back in the late 80s was the antithesis of rock and well, more heavy metal and wrestling.
Oh, yeah.
Like, all the metal guys love Warrior because he had long hair, came to the ring to a pounding double bass riff, and looked like he was insane. And then, you know, wrestled for 30 seconds, and that'd be it. But all the guys, like Zakk Wylde to this day, James Hellwig, that's my guy. He's the greatest. But there's a connection between rock and roll and wrestling to this day, even still.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, and that was like a lot of stuff that I could take from that world to wrestling was the energy and the emotion and like just being able to project that. Like if you're a hardcore front man and you're just kind of like standing there with a mic in your hand, and
yeah.
it's no one gonna give
it
a shit.
Work.
You gotta jump around, you gotta yeah. move, you gotta look crazy. Like, so the facials and everything was like natural for me to like kind of like look at someone like I'm gonna kill them. And yeah.
it's,
like,
oh. it's part of the scene.
Yeah.
Last two questions for you. What are your plans here in AEW? Not only you've only been here for a few weeks, what's kind of your overall goal?
You know, I think with House of Black, we really have something different to offer. You know, I don't want to really compare it to anything directly, but it has like a very, you know, Ministry of Darkness aura around it. Mm-hmm. And that was like something that latched onto me as a kid, like watching all these like crazy right. looking people and like, you know, crucifying Stone Cold.
It wasn't whatever. A cross.
it was
an Undertaker symbol. That's what we were told.
But that was like, you know, that was stuff that was like, this is awesome. Like yeah. that was stuff that like grabbed me as a kid and was like, this is what I want in wrestling. This is what I want, you know, in movies and music and everything. So to kind of be able to put our spin on something like that and be the darker element of wrestling that I feel like has been kind of missing for quite some time, is awesome. And I feel like there's a lot to work with and there's a lot to grow with. And, you know, I think that Malachi is one of the best wrestlers on the planet currently.
Great character.
So too. Being able to learn from him and being able to team with him, I feel like our chemistry works well together. Our styles are very different, but they work in unison. You know, he has more of a kickboxing fighter style where mine is just more like brutish, you know, forearms and chops yep. and slams and stuff like that. But they are, they're, different types of violence that work within the same realm.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that House of Black has just begun here in AEW.
Last question for you. What's your favorite match that you ever had? Does one of them stand out more than others?
Oh, man. Favorite match. There's a few that stand out. Obviously, that match with Rocky and Okada, for many different reasons,
right,
might be one of my favorite matches. I got to wrestle Kenta in New Japan, which was like, that was a bucket list moment.
Sure.
I had a match with Tom Lawler during quarantine. And like, these were both of these matches, Kenta and Tom Lawler, were in front of no people.
So
it's like, we had these like 20-minute matches where we're like, I hope somebody likes this.
Yeah. But then, it's hard to tell. Yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe currently my favorite match, I got to wrestle Tomohiro Ishii on a New Japan live show. And that was an awesome moment.
In Japan or here?
Here in, gotcha. It was actually in Los Angeles.
Oh, God. Yeah.
But that was like, you know, someone that I looked up to and watched a lot when I was training. It was like, that was kind of a dream match for me. It was a match that was supposed to happen pre-COVID and then got slated. So to be able to kind of do that and like have a really good match against him was awesome. And it's like, you know, I came to the back and, you know, guys like Josh Barnett and like Shibata were like, good job. And it's like, well, these guys don't like anything. So for them to say it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, that's great, man. I'm looking forward to many more awesome matches from you, and it's good to have you. And like I said, we got to do the Andy Williams, Brody King, Chris Jericho jam. We'll get Frankie Kazarian to play bass. We just need a drummer.
Chris Dickinson plays drums.
Well, there you go. We'll open the forbidden band door as well.
Yeah, there we go.
Thanks, dude.